The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and if you haven't noticed already, I love books. So does Michael Derda. We had him on the show 18 years ago, and we loved talking about books. Let's listen.
Tell us about your family.
Well, I came from a very blue-collar, working-class family, East European. My father's side was Russian. My mother's side was Slovak. My father had quit school when he was 16 to go to work in the steel mill during the Depression. And when he came back from the Navy after the Second World War, he married my mother and I was born, and he was sort of stuck working in the steel mill, a job he loathed his entire life. My mother was basically a homemaker for much of the time when she had children, although she did go to work as a cashier at W.T. Grant's department store. But we were very much a classic working class family. We didn't have much money. I have three sisters. But I have a large extended family in Lorraine. My mother had 10 in her family. My father had 4. So I had lots of cousins and aunts and uncles around. So the growing up in Lorraine was really, when I was a kid, I used to say I couldn't wait to get out of the town. But I look back on it now as rather a kind of golden age. The 50s, you felt quite secure despite the Cold War. Lorraine's population is 65,000, so you could ride your bicycle everywhere. It was really quite an idyllic time.
The book is an open book, Coming of Age in the Heartland. Michael Derda wrote it, and he joins us on the program today. I didn't even try to count the number of references that you make to specific books, but this your passion for books is so infectious, and you come up and this isn't highbrow stuff. You talk about every single thing that interested you, everything that you read, the transitions in your life from books that we think of as children's books to candy.
Yeah, and classics, too.
And classics.
Well, you know, when you write anything that's autobiographical, you have to figure out some organizing principle. And books had been the organizing principle of my early life, and still, I mean, my job has been involved with books. I went to graduate school in comparative literature. So that was clearly what I needed to use as the thread to tell the story of my early years. I also wanted to paint a portrait of life in this small town during the 50s and of a kind of working class culture. The books were always important to me. Comic books, Hardy Boys, Tarzan, Sherlock Holmes. When I got to be in seventh grade, someone told me that Crime and Punishment was a mystery story. So I read it and loved it. And after that, moved on to other, you know, grown-up books. I didn't really have any, you know, great guidance until junior high school. I just read what I could find. There weren't any bookstores in Lorraine, so I would ask my aunts and cousins and neighbors if they had anything good to read. So I've discovered big little books from the 40s and older comic books. And by the time I got, when I was a senior in high school, I even did my senior paper on true confession stories because I'd seen these magazines all my life and had never read any. And so I read a whole bunch of those and wrote a paper about them. I liked words. I liked language. I liked stories. Mostly I liked the adventure of living another life. I think when we're kids, we read books as a way of trying out, you know, modes of life, of seeing what kind of person we would like to be, or, you know, if we're lucky. I talk a good deal at one point about The Count of Monte Cristo, which for me is the great novel of education, because it tells the story of this young, ignorant sailor, Edmond Dantes, who's imprisoned for life, framed, on the Chateau d'If, kind of the Alcatraz of France. And there he meets the Abbé Faria, who teaches him languages and manners and culture and all, you know, all that you need to be a gentleman, so that when he finally escapes, he's able to emerge no longer as this ignorant, naive, bumbling young sailor, but as the suave, debonair, urbane, darkly mysterious Count of Monte Cristo. I kind of came to see that sort of as a to use a fancy word, a paradigm for education, that we have these visions of what we'd like to be. And through books and reading and school, we hope to come at least somewhat close to them. Although you can see how far short I've fallen of the Count of Monte Cristo.
I really laughed when you have this teacher in high school. And you were rather challenging for this poor woman, weren't you?
Yes. I was never what you would call a docile student unless I had a teacher that I liked. I was lucky enough to have some really good teachers in 7th and 8th grade and again in 12th grade for French. But after having become crazy about reading novels and poetry and all kinds of serious things, I started high school in 9th grade and discovered that I had a teacher who only wanted to do grammar, teach us how to diagram sentences. And back then I could think of nothing more boring than diagramming sentences. Although I now like to bear in mind Gertrude Stein's remark when she says, you know, I do not think that anything has ever been more exciting than diagramming sentences. But Miss Raymond was, I determined, going to be my enemy for the entire school year. And I didn't care what grade I got in English. I was a smart alecky kid by that point. Insufferable, I realize now. So I decided that one way I would annoy her was through my book reports. The first one was on, we had to do fiction, and we announced them to the class, and we presented our papers orally. And it was Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace in 2 volumes, unabridged. And she looked at me, couldn't believe I'd read this book. I was the class clown and provocateur, and I assured her that I had, and I could describe the course of the story. And she had no choice but to give me an A, but really with a lot of regret. The next month, we had to do nonfiction. And back then, everybody was in my class was reading Dr. Tom Dooley's very propagandistic, The Night They Burned the Mountain, about a missionary doctor in Southeast Asia and all the evil communists. So naturally, my second book of nonfiction was The Communist Manifesto by Marx and Engels. And I proclaimed its manifest truth to the class, called for the working men of all, you know, countries to unite, glancing at Miss Raymond as I said this, and shortly afterwards was called down to the school principal, who couldn't figure out what was going on here because I'd done well in junior high school, and I have a talent for scoring really well on standardized tests, but I was just turning into this awful student. And I said I didn't like this teacher. I didn't think she was a good teacher for me, and I wasn't going to change. I was a nonconformist. So the whole year went this way. For the final book report, I kept thinking, well, how can I cap this school year? What should be the last thing I review? For a moment, I toyed with the idea of reviewing the 12th grade English grammar book as though it were a novel and take it very seriously. And then I said, now. And then I thought of taking the latest issue of Superman and analyzing that as though it were a serious novel. But I finally ended up writing about the concise Cambridge history of English literature in 2 volumes, which I'd been wanting to read anyway. But Miss Raymond never quite got over me that year, I'm afraid.
Mm. You know, if I'd been in your high school, I would have been hanging with you.
Well, I had some good friends. We hung out. One of the things I wanted to show in this book is that although I was a bookish kid, no question of that, I wasn't really exactly a nerd. I mean, I may have been a bit of a nerd when I was in elementary school, but I had friends who had GTOs and motorcycles, and I drove those. I had summer jobs in the steel mill and the home improvement company. I worked in a bar on Sundays cleaning up and got to keep all the money I found on the floor. So I was not just a kid with his nose in a book, although by preference I would have my nose in a book.
Your father was worried about his son reading all these books. Yet at one point, didn't he give you $100 to read the Bible?
True. My father was very much a dreamy, visionary kind of man who never was going to act on a lot of his daydreams, but hoped his children would fulfill them. He took me to the library for the first time, but later he decided that I was getting too bookish and would frequently knock books out of my hand and tell me to go outside and play or go down to the basement and build something. But at some point, he realized that the Bible was something that's worth knowing, And I had no, I was raised Catholic, but I didn't like following the Mass. And so I actually had asked if I could read some of the Bible as a, you know, stories, just as a change from listening to Latin for an hour and 10 minutes. And my dad said, okay, I will give you $100 if you read the whole Bible. So I did. It took me, you know, nearly a year. And except for, you know, parts of Numbers and Leviticus, it was all pretty darn good.
At one point, I think you were 14 years old, you were coming home and you heard your parents talking about you. And this was very upsetting, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. My parents argued a lot while I was growing up, my father being an extremely tyrannical paterfamilias. But I did come home one day and found them arguing about why was I so strange or weird or something. I can't remember exactly what. And I decided to run away. I was 14. I talked a friend into coming with me. We met in the park, Central Park, a few blocks from both our houses at 4 o'clock in the morning, and walked out of town and started hitchhiking toward Pittsburgh. We were gone for 5 days. Eventually, we were both tired and sick of each other's company, and so we finally came home. My father, of course, didn't believe I'd ever gone anywhere. He thought I'd been sleeping in a barn somewhere on a farm or, you know, just out the skirts of town. My mother didn't know whether to laugh or cry or, you know, punish me or what, that I was home safe. She was convinced I was going to be found, you know, dead lying in a ditch someplace. But it was a great adventure, and it was in some ways a kind of apotheosis of the boys' adventure stories I loved as a kid. And these sorts of things were always happening, in a way, to the Hardy Boys or to Ken Holt or Rick Brandt, these series heroes, of teenage heroes that I so admired. But then, you know, I at the same time that I was running away from home, about that same year, I was coming back from the movies one day with a couple of my friends, and we stopped in a stationery store so they could steal some ballpoint pens. And I noticed a rack of paperbacks, and I went over to this paperback rack and was looking around, see if there was anything good to read, and saw a book called Immortal Poems of the English Language. And I picked it up, and I flipped it open, and I came to a poem by A.E. Housman, a famous poem, When I Was 1 in 20. And I read it, and I liked it, and I bought this book, and my friends razzed me to no end. Everyone knew how prissy poetry was, and nobody read poems. But I liked the lines were memorable. They appealed to me. Language was important, at least for me. So I had this relatively long walk to high school the following year. So I took to memorizing poems as I walked along. So basically all the poetry I know, if it wasn't in that book, I don't know it. But I know a lot of that book by heart. And some of those things, of course, stood me in good stead. When I was later spurned by a blonde heartthrob in high school, I sent her a letter afterwards and ended with the first stanza of a poem by Yeats called For Anne Gregory that goes, "Never shall a young man, thrown into despair by those great honey-colored ramparts at your ear, love you for yourself alone and not your yellow hair." And I said, well, that'll show her. And she was no doubt glad to be rid of such a strange guy as I was. When I got to Oberlin, I should say that there was no certainty I would go to college. No, my high school was supposedly, you know, one of the top schools in the state in juvenile delinquency, about 20% black, 20% Hispanic, the rest Eastern European and Italian second, third generation immigrant kids. I'd say only maybe 20 or 30 kids went to college out of 585. But I did have this knack for scoring very well on tests, and so I decided to apply to a small liberal arts college. A teacher had told me that's where I should go, and Oberlin is 13 miles from Lorain. So I first made my parents promise never to come visit me if I got in. Not so much that I was embarrassed by them, but I didn't want my mother hovering over me while I was trying to go out on dates. And I applied, and Ohio University was my backup. And I got a scholarship and a loan and a job working in the laundry and went off to Oberlin and went through a terrible time my fall semester of culture shock and of just utterly dislocated and feeling out of my league. My roommate was the son of an Oklahoma oil millionaire. My two best friends there had both gone to Andover. One was a chess champion of his state. The other could whistle Mozart operas from beginning to end. I fell in love with a girl from the South and thought she was Scarlett O'Hara. Everyone at Oberlin could play the piano. I could play the accordion, which sort of summed up how I felt. But I was taking classes in English, my first English class, and through a series of events, I was in a class called 17th Century English Metaphysical Poetry, taught by a man who was about to retire at the end of the year named Andrew Bongiorno. We gave weekly tests, little quizzes, essay quizzes. And my very first grade in college, my very first grade in English was a D+. And my things didn't improve much after that. And I was taking French classes where the teacher would say, you know, what's the worst grade you can get? And end by saying it would be a C+, because that means you're mediocre. And I was always getting a C+. So I nearly decided to drop out of college in that fall, but I finally told my father about how unhappy I was. And he gave me the advice that really altered a lot of my later life. I'd been a smart alecky kid, coasting on whatever gifts I had. And he said, well, some of these kids are smarter than you, and some of them have advantages that you haven't had. But if you work harder than anybody else, if you put in the time, you'll be fine. So I turned myself into a grind. I studied constantly. I went to the conservatory and listened to music. Went to the art museum, looked at paintings, audited art classes. I read Emily Post's Guide to Etiquette cover to cover. I borrowed the millionaire kid's clothes when I went out on dates with the Southern Belle. And I strove as much as I could to gain what I thought of as a kind of classical liberal education. And gradually I came to realize that what I wanted out of college was not so much to find a profession, but I wanted to be learned. That sounds very old-fashioned, but I wanted to be learned, and I also wanted to be comfortable in the world. I wanted to understand the history of the earth, I wanted to understand the past. I wanted to understand people of different cultures. I didn't want to feel parochial, just narrow bound, just a kid who was a kid who worked in a steel mill and who was from Lorain, Ohio. And so I worked hard to do well and did do well the last 2 years of college. But that was my dream. And we always fall short of our dreams, but that's still been behind a lot of what I have done. I don't know. I remember once I was working, it's not in the book, but I talk about similar things in the book. I was working for a home improvement company hanging aluminum siding with these two good old boys. One was an English Cockney and one was a West Virginia mountain boy. And they would get drunk, and they were just real characters. And we had, we'd razz each other just as you would on the job, And I went from working with them one afternoon to getting on a plane for France, and the next day I was dancing at a ball with the ambassador to France's wife.
Huh.
And I thought, well, this is sort of what I wanted to be able to do, to feel comfortable in both these worlds. I felt more comfortable with the good old boys than with than at the ball, but I could do it. And that was important to me. I was very much a young man from the provinces.
I loved your story when you were working with that home improvement company when you guys had the 50-foot ladder, but they need to read the book to find that story, because that is such a funny, that's like Three Stooges stuff.
It is, yeah. You'll laugh, you'll cry.
You talk about Oberlin, and you talk about these mentors that you had, this French teacher from high school, and this gentleman that was a father of one of your friends from Oberlin, the writer that you met in New York City. How important is it to have a mentor to you?
Well, I was younger. When I was younger, it was very important to me to have these models to have people who cared about, in my case, books and reading. Because except for a few teachers, I don't think I ever saw any grown-up reading a book. It was just not part of the culture that I lived in. And I should say at this point, it's not that I thought that I was better than anybody else because I liked books. It was just almost something genetic or, you know, matter of happenstance that I learned to read, and I found language and stories fascinating. You know, but I have cousins who can, you know, could kill any known, you know, beast or bird with any known weapon at, you know, 500 yards. Or just, and I used to hang out with them and shoot 22s, and we, you know, and they can fix cars. They were great athletes at school, and you know, I envied those qualities as much as, you know, any achievement in school or in the classroom. But I was good at this, and so since I was good at it, this is what I spent more of my time on than the other things. The mentors, they told me about books, and they helped bring me and books together. An eighth grade teacher had us read fairly serious, you know, short novels, and we read 1984, and we read things by Katherine Ann Porter and Gogol and Melville and Faulkner. We read The Unvanquished and all kinds of books. He would also go into Cleveland for a night school course, and he would buy paperbacks if you wanted, because you couldn't find any in Lorraine. And I remember the first book I had him buy for me was Dale Carnegie's How to Stop Worrying and Start Living, which shows you what kind of a kid I was in eighth grade. And the second was Thoreau's Walden, books which I realize now were both attempts to figure out how should a person live. That is, Carnegie, who's, you know, dismissed these days somewhat for a kind of crass approach to social relations, still valued, you know, the kind of civilities. You know, he was teaching you how to get on in society, how to get along with people, how to approach them, how to convince them of your, you know, your worthiness. And Thoreau made a good compliment to that because he was saying, you know, you needed to look into yourself to find out what you are and to become what you are and not what society wants you to be. So the pair of them, they developed different sides of at least my character, and were both equally valuable. So I talk about Dale Carnegie and Thoreau with, you know, very similar ways in this book. And mentors in general were doing that kind of thing for me. They were giving me books and they were giving me models of behavior, of intellectual achievement.
Michael Derda joins us. His memoir is An Open Book, Coming of Age in the Heartland. Michael is a writer and senior editor for the Washington Post Book World. And you've won the Pulitzer Prize. What did you win that for? Was there a specific thing, or was it for a body of work?
It was. I won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism in 1993. This was for a collection or a selection from the essays and reviews that I had written that year. I think there you can submit up to 10 pieces of work for categories like commentary or criticism. And there was, again, even in the books I reviewed that won that year, a great variety. Reviewed a children's book by Maurice Sendak, an Elmore Leonard thriller, a new translation of Crime and Punishment, book of journalism by the great New Yorker writer, one of my favorite writers, Joseph Mitchell, a book by an African novelist, Ben Okri, a book by Daniel Boorstin called The Creators, which I thought was terrible and was a very critical review. So, you know, the usual hodgepodge, sort of thing I do at Bookworld, you know, over the years. So I'm pretty eclectic.
Joe Mitchell, what an incredible writer.
The best.
And the story of when he just kind of stopped and he continued to go to work at the New Yorker. And it was decades, wasn't it, that he really didn't publish anything?
Yeah, I don't think he published anything for the last 25, maybe 30 years of his life. His best material was from the late 30s and the 40s and, well, into the 50s. Really, he published, five books. There's an early book called My Ears Are Bent, which has been reissued recently. But there were four main collections, and they were gathered together in an omnibus called Up in the Old Hotel. But for me, Mitchell was the best sort of literary nonfiction writer of the century, in America at least. He had this wonderfully wistful tone. And he was always going out into New York and discovering eccentrics and madmen and isolatos and working class people and gypsies. He never looked at the people who were, you know, sort of at the top of the food chain, so to speak. But he was always looking for outsiders and marginalized people, people who ran weird little museums or were fishermen. And he wrote about them so with just aching beauty. I mean, and but without being corny, you could feel their lives and you could feel the sorrows of their lives and the joys. And just a brilliant, brilliant writer.
Mm. My guest has been Michael Derda. His book is An Open Book, Coming of Age in the Heartland. He also has a paperback that's just come out of readings, essays, and literary entertainments. This is stuff that's been published in the newspaper?
Yeah. Readings, again with the subtitle Essays and Literary Entertainments, is a collection of columns I wrote for the Post over about 10 years. Once a month, instead of writing a book review, that is a piece about a current book, they allowed me to write any kind of essay I wanted about reading, books, publishing, book collecting, anything that would in some ways inspire people to go out and read more. A lot of those essays were personal, but no, you know, but some of them were, well, the variety includes, there's a list of my 100 favorite comic novels with brief annotations, a list of great sex scenes in literature. There's a piece about searching for a forgotten novel called I Am Jonathan Scrivener. But the most popular pieces that I wrote over that period were the ones that were very personal and about my family, including one called Listening to My Father. And in some ways, An Open Book grew out of those personal essays in readings, where I'd written about my childhood and early reading habits. And people would say, you know, you should write more about that. And so I finally listened. But Readings is a book I'm very fond of. Indiana University Press published it in hardback in 2000, and Norton has now brought it out in a very pretty trade paperback. And it gives you a wider sampling, I think, of the kind of thing I've done with my, you know, years at the Washington Post, since I write about all kinds of books and still talk very much in a very personal voice. Because I should add, I don't really think of myself as a literary critic. I think of myself as an essayist, I suppose, but an appreciator, an enthusiast, somebody who writes about books with affection and hopes to impart some of his own passion for that particular, you know, poem or novel to others. At least that's what I've tried to do in what I've written for the Post over the years and in both Readings and An Open Book.
I finished reading An Open Book, and I just got a copy of Readings the other day, and I began to read it. And I got into your introduction, and you said in the introduction something about go slowly, ration the stories over several weeks. And I thought, well, I got to follow directions. So I'm going to savor this one. I have not read this one yet.
You'll laugh, you'll cry with this one, too. It's great, he said modestly.
Well, we really appreciate you coming out to see us.
Oh, it's been great to be here. I love Antioch. It, you know, this wonderful autumn weather in Ohio makes my heart break that I'm not, as I originally intended to be, a college professor in a small town just like this one.
Mm-hmm. That was the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back to October 2003, my conversation with Michael Derda, who loves books just about as much as I do, or maybe even more, talking about An Open Book, Coming of Age in the Heartland. For the Best of the Book Nook, thanks for tuning in.